Yeah. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I'm so happy to be with you again and to enter into our third week. As those of you who were here early enough to hear the mantras being chanted probably figured out which form of the Divine Feminine we are going to be practicing with this evening. This is the evening of Saraswati, who is one of the great goddesses of wisdom. The traditions all over the world understand wisdom as a feminine power. The Greeks called her Sophia. Another Greek tradition, she's Athena. In the Indian tradition, she is Saraswati. She also has different faces, different forms. There's a form of the wisdom goddess known as Tara, a form known as Matangi. All of these different forms, faces of wisdom have different qualities, different capacities that they give us. Some of them are goddesses of the highest wisdom. Some of them are goddesses of more mundane forms of language understanding. Saraswati is one who bridges all of them, and especially, and this is one of the qualities that I very much want to engage with you this week, especially in the forms of creativity and speech. Saraswati is also, of course, the goddess of music and the patron goddess of musicians in India. So we'll also talk about that a bit. But specifically, my hope is that this week, in the week to come, we can use our connection with the goddess Saraswati to really look into the way we're using language, the way we're using speech, without being scared to use words boldly and audaciously, to also recognize how the words we use affect the atmosphere, affect our own bodies, affect others. And this is actually one of the great gifts that Saraswati gives us, is the discrimination to understand how our words affect not just ourselves, but everyone and the world around us. So let's begin today by finding, of course, a posture, sensing the connection of the sits bones with the seat, really having the experience of rooting, rooting down to the earth. There's a kind of an active quality when we consider roots. Let's say roots moving from our sits bones down into the earth, roots moving from our feet down into the earth. Imagine that your sits bones, your feet, your buttocks are like the trunk of a huge tree that sends forth big, thick roots into the earth and little tiny rootlets so that nourishment, strength, power is flowing up into our posture. And then inhaling down into the base, exhaling up through the crown, letting your shoulder blades release onto the back, and beginning to allow your attention to flow into the heart. One of the real gifts of goddess practice is becoming familiar with the different ways that goddess transmits her shakti, transmits her energy into us. Sometimes that transmission seems to come through the crown so that we actually feel as though we're receiving energy from above through the top of the head. Sometimes it seems to come up through the earth so that we feel that we are receiving it from below. And for many of us, that energy flows through the heart. It flows horizontally, as though the universe is breathing us, as though the universe is simply flowing into us. One of the images that I really love as I contemplate the transmission that comes to us through reality, if we pay attention, is this sense of the universe making love to us, so that as you find your posture, you can just take a moment or two to feel her presence flowing to you through the breath. Saraswati's name means she who flows. She's not only a goddess, she's also a river. A river that flows invisibly underground, which is a very big thing when you think about how Saraswati is brought into our experience, because very often she feels subtle and hidden, even though Saraswati's energy, which is the energy of sound itself, the creative energy of sound, even though Saraswati's energy permeates, pervades everything, we often don't recognize her. We often don't realize her. We often don't see her. So as you find your posture, as you breathe with Shakti, we'll begin to invoke her with these mantras that we heard being chanted by Krishnadas before we began this afternoon. You've received, I hope, as a male through the grace of Deb, the simple words of this invocation, but they're so simple that I think even if you didn't receive them or if you didn't have a chance to open your inbox, you can find them, follow them as I speak them. So the words are Aum, Aim, which is the Bij mantra, the seed syllable, specifically connected to the goddess Saraswati, and is also connected to inspiration, connected to the beginnings of things, to the start of things, to speech itself, to the impulse to create. And then as we chant her seed syllable, Aim, we add her name and then the word Namaha, meaning I honor, I bow to. I offer myself in prostration to she who is the source of all language. So Aum Aim Saraswatyai, the yai ending shows that we are addressing the goddess, particularly specifically Namaha. Om, we bow to the goddess who is of the form of inspiration. And we'll chant 9 times. I'll chant, and you can chant along with me, or listen. So big breath in. Om Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. 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 And one more for good measure. Om Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. And I want to chant one more invocation. This is a chant that you will receive in your homework, but I was inspired as we were beginning to chant it myself. This is a chant I practice every day, and it's also the, it's called the Saraswati Dhyana Shloka. It's a chant that actually offers the form through which Saraswati is meditated on. And these verses are the ones that students recite at the beginning of the school year in order to invoke Saraswati's grace for their studies. So, and the English translation of the verse, which we really will recite and contemplate as a prayer for her grace as we begin. May Saraswati, goddess of wisdom, learning, and speech, protect me by removing my intellectual dullness. She is white as the kunda flower, white as the moon, white as snow. She is dressed in white and seated on a white lotus flower. She plays the lute and is adored by the gods Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. And it goes like this. Yakundendu tushara hara davala yashubra vastra vrita yavina varadanda manditakara yashveta padmasana yabrahma chuta shankara prabhritibir devesya yavandita Samam patu Saraswati Bhagavati Nishesha Jad Yapaha. So with your attention to the posture, your eyes closed, let's continue by bringing into our awareness the altar that we created last week, the altar that connects us all. It's an altar made of light. And as you imagine this altar stretching out between us, stretching out in such a way that everyone listening now and listening as we replay this call on the MP3, this altar holds our intention and our experience of grace. It's made of light. And as I envision this altar of light, I see it in rainbow colors. Saraswati is the color white because white is the white light contains all the rainbow colors. They're all contained inside the white light, and that's why her color is white, because it is actually that it represents the white light that's the source of all colors, of all manifestation. So imagine this altar as being made of a white light that keeps undulating into rainbow colors. Sometimes it's red, sometimes it's blue, perhaps it's yellow. And you experience the moving, living quality of the light that is the altar. in the midst of the altar, imagine a flame. Imagine it held in a beautiful carved jewel-like holder. Perhaps the holder is made of diamonds, perhaps of rubies, of sapphires. It, like the altar itself, it scintillates with a jewel-like radiance. And your attention comes into the flame at the center. You feel or imagine, or for some of you, even visualize the form of the infinitely subtle goddess Saraswati taking shape within the flame, her form so subtle that we can't always see it, just the way a flame forms and dissolves, the way a flame dances, her form dances. And as you consider the presence of the goddess Saraswati, imagine that from her form emanates the exquisitely beautiful sounds of the primal mantras, Om, Aim, Om, Aim, as though the flame itself is saying these words. And then with your next inhalation, feel that you inhale the altar into your heart. And just take a moment to recognize that all of us listening, all of us participating, are connected through the presence of the Saraswati altar that both connects us as the center of our shared space of consciousness and also connects us as the altar that we have allowed to be taken in to our heart center. And with your awareness in the heart, silently repeat to yourself the mantras, Aum Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. Aum Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. Aum Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. Aum Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. There's a wonderful book from the tradition of Kabbalah, which is called Your Word is Fire. And it's a collection of stories from the Hasidic masters of 18th century Europe. Like the sages of the Indian tradition, Jewish mystics deeply believed in the creative power of language. And, of course, this goes back to the book of Genesis, where God is said to have created the world through sound, through language, through command, through words. Let there be light, and there was light. And this power in language, according to these sages, is our own power. We have that creative power. One master of this tradition wrote, "The holy letters of prayer may be used as telescopes into the hidden ways of God." So as you say the great during prayer, the greatness of God appears in these very letters. One sees the power of God in the words, the powerful, the awe of God in the words, the awesome. the letters themselves have the power to draw forth these powers from above. And this is really at the heart of what we celebrate when we contemplate Goddess Saraswati. Through our connection with Saraswati, our words catch fire. Our language has power. Our language has truth. So that the masters of the Hindu Veda, and Saraswati was originally a Vedic goddess. She's a very old goddess. One of her early names was Vach, which means speech. So she is literally identified with the empowered mantric speech of the great priests who mediate between the hidden worlds above and the human world and make thoughts specific, make thoughts actions, make thoughts deeds. So if you remember, Shakti acts through vibration, through sound. This is, of course, a tremendously important aspect of the tradition that we're studying, the tradition that we're invoking, because the physical universe was believed to arise from the primal vibration of the sound, Om, which, much as scientists now consider the Big Bang to have done, emanated from the stillness of the unknowable void beyond all things. And the Vedic masters were essentially masters of creative sound, that is, masters of mantra and speech. And the crucial truth, and for me this has been a tremendously significant thing to contemplate over the years, the crucial truth that they recognize is that the power in sounds is not in the written letters, or even in the way the letters are put together to form words. The power in the sounds, though it's contained in the letters and words, actually comes from your connection to the inner source, which is silent, which is unmanifest, and which is the essence of Saraswati. So when you make that connection to the goddess, your word would be true, and not only true, but eloquent, and not only eloquent, but beautiful. So the mantras you recited would literally call down the deity, call in the divinity, bring the divine world into the physical world, into the human world. So Saraswati, the goddess of speech, was held in the early Vedic tradition as really the heart of the whole of religious practice. And there's a hymn called the Devi Sukta in the Rig Veda, which is quite a long hymn in which the goddess speaks. She describes herself. And she says, "I am the sovereign queen, the treasure house of all treasures, whose breathing forth gives birth to all the worlds, so vast am I in greatness. One whom I love, I make formidable, a priest, a sage, a singer." So Saraswati speaks to the value, the values of language. And what I have found and what I would like to invite you to is the implication that when we have a true connection with the goddess of speech, with Saraswati, our words will not be idle. You know, it's one of the things that the Shiva Sutras has this very mysterious sutra, which says even his gossip is mantra. Kata Japaha is what it says. Even his gossip is mantra, referring to the state of a realized being. So when you have that connection, according to the tradition, whatever you say becomes true. And of course, that means that we need to be very careful with our language, because the more we realize how powerful words are, the more we recognize that not only the words we speak, but also the words we think have a power to affect us. And of course, neuroscience tells us more and more about the connection between our language, the language we use in thought or in words, how our language affects our own body. And, you know, there's a great deal to be said on the subject, a great deal of healing power in sound, and I know that several of you here work with the healing power in sound. But the whole secret of it is to learn how to connect our tongue, so to speak, to the heart, and then to allow ourselves to become aware of the stillness from which words can arise, and how when words arise from that stillness, they have a completely different effect than the words that just come forth as our normal blah, blah, blah. So as Durga is the Shakti of warriors and rulers, as Lakshmi embodies the power of fertility and prosperity and wealth, as Kali is the force of revolution, Saraswati rules over the subtle domain of culture, music, everything we do with words. She's also the patron deity of teachers and students, of master musicians. She lives in mantras, of course, which are really the most creative forms of language. She's invoked by the great Indian classical musicians. If you go on YouTube and watch a video of Ravi Shankar or Ali Akbar Khan, you'll often see a little picture of Saraswati next to their seat. And this is interesting because most Indian classical music actually comes from Persia, and many of the musicians, the master musicians of classical Indian music, are from Muslim backgrounds, and yet they pay homage to the goddess Saraswati. So deeply is she engaged in the creative process that musicians live for. Speak the word in such a way, one of great master says, that the light shines through it. Enter into the word with all your body and all your strength. Let the words of prayer be a window through which you see to the end of the earth. The window is the light, the power inside the word. The window is Saraswati. So we will fall silent from time to time as we speak. And I want to ask you in the silence to just spend a few seconds, maybe 30 seconds, cultivating this mantra, Aum Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. Aum Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. Aum Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. Abhinavagupta, the great Kashmir Shaiva sage, has a hymn to Saraswati. He invokes her like this. He says, "You are intelligence, intelligence, intelligence. Your names are memory, eloquence, and hymn of praise." So I find this recognition that Saraswati lives in us as the intelligence that not only acts through the mind, not only acts through our creativity, but also lives as the creative intelligence of the cells. The great sage Aurobindo, in his little book, The Mother, describes four faces of the goddess. Of course, we describe many more, recognizing that goddess has many faces, but in fact, and this is really the secret that the great goddess practitioners understand, all these faces are the faces of one goddess. She has many different facets. She has literally thousands of facets, not just 1,000 names, but many more names. But she is at heart one. That said, we can begin to recognize the presence of Saraswati in those moments, I find particularly, when our intelligence flows, when it rises up to show us something that we didn't know, when ideas seem to come out of nowhere, when you realize that you can learn something just by working to learn it, that even though you may know absolutely nothing about a subject, if you bend your natural intelligence to it, wisdom will arise about it. And on a deeper level, the insight that arises about the invisible world, about the nature of life, this is also the gift of Saraswati. It's said, actually, that Saraswati's greatest gift, the true fruit of invoking Saraswati, is what the particular hymn I'm thinking of calls Brahmanishta, that is, the secret knowledge of the Absolute. So she gives us spiritual awakening, especially the awakening that comes through insight. And she's also the Shakti behind the computer, behind the whole world of telecommunications and information technology. And I actually have come to believe that every sort of innovation, every technological discovery, actually comes in the form of a download from the goddess Saraswati, whether it's in the arts, in science, in math. You know, Saraswati Shakti is, Saraswati is also the goddess of mathematical insight. And I like to think of her as a kind of light field that kind of hovers in the atmosphere and periodically downloads new ideas, new realizations, new innovations into the human minds that are not only open to her, but which have also, it goes without saying, prepared ourselves to receive her insight, because, of course, insight can come to us, but if we haven't actually cultivated our own field, we won't know how to use it. So Saraswati is connected both to the throat chakra, to the voice. She's also connected to the Ajna chakra, which is the center of the mind. And we could say that in one sense, when there are glitches in our communication, whether in hearing or in expressing, those are blocks in the Saraswati energy. And by that understanding, Saraswati actually has the power to open the flow of creativity or ideas or language. So just as Lakshmi's gifts of abundance are part of what sustains us on the physical level, Saraswati's energy is at the heart of everything that flows between us in all the forms of communication, not only speech, but Saraswati is the sound, all the sounds of nature. She's the sound of the wind. She's the calls of birds. She's the sound of running water. And just as Lakshmi's gift of giving and receiving needs to be understood and held in balance, Saraswati's flow of creative sound also needs to be balanced. Too little and there's no communication, too much and there's overload. So if you look at a painting of Saraswati, and there's a few on the course page, although in our paintings she's wearing a colored sari. For some reason, we had a very hard time finding a painting of Saraswati with a white sari. But you'll see that in all the paintings, she's sitting near water. She has long flowing hair. She holds a stringed instrument called a veena, which is usually translated as a lute. It's one of those instruments like a sitar, which has many strings and many talents. It can play at all sorts of harmonics and resonances. The vina, of course, represents the creativity of sound, the harmonious vibrations that actually manifest as the physical world. In one hand, she holds a rosary, which is, in many of the paintings, made of crystal, signifying the absolute purity of mantric speech. And in the other hand, she holds a book, and of course we know what that means. She sits on the bank of a softly flowing river, and let's just take a moment, and we'll come back to this again and again. Let's take a moment to find her. Perhaps you imagine yourself sitting on the bank of a river, a meandering, very beautiful, very clear river. And because it's a divine river, it's a holy river, it flows between banks that are covered with luscious grass and clover and jewel-like flowers. So imagine yourself sitting there and recognize that Saraswati is seated in front of you. She's dressed in moonbeams that have somehow translated themselves into a garment, as though she's literally draped in the light of the moon, and her skin is luminous. She has four arms. She's playing the vina, holding the book and the rosary. And as you imagine her presence, her very subtle presence, sometimes our experience of Saraswati is so subtle that we almost can't find her. Just as sometimes when we tune into consciousness, to awareness, it's so subtle that we have to notice very carefully in order to find it, to be aware of it. Saraswati is that subtle. Her light is the light that arises in the third eye, in the Ajna chakra during meditation. She's the light that illuminates the mind. Saraswati's mount is the swan, and not just any swan, a particular form of swan who is said to swim in a holy lake near Mount Kailas in Tibet. The swan is, again, according to mythology, has the ability to separate what is true from what is illusory. And this quality of discrimination, viveka in Sanskrit, is said to have the ability, the swan who represents viveka is said to have the ability to separate milk from water. And supposedly if you pour milk into the river, this swan will only drink the milk. So in this sense, she incarnates discrimination, precision, the capacity for telling the difference between what is true and what is false. And before we go a little bit more into her mythology, I want to point out that at the heart of Saraswati's transmission is an understanding about wisdom as something that comes through oral transmission. In other words, Saraswati is emblematic of a time when the highest forms of knowledge were never passed on in writing. They were passed on from the mouth to the ear, as the saying goes. They were they came through the oral tradition. So the transmission always happened through the voice, which meant that every phrase or every word that came from the teacher or the priest was supposed to be infused with the teacher's own connection to Saraswati in the heart, or actually manifesting through the Ajna Chakra. So the transmission of knowledge and the receiving of knowledge would begin when you would listen to the wisdom that was being transmitted. You literally opened yourself to hear the wisdom. And then you would hold the words, and not only the words, but the intention behind the words, the wisdom coming through the words. You would hold it in your mind, and then you would meditate on it. And the teaching about how knowledge was transmitted was always reflected in a prayer, which was traditionally sung at the beginning of learning gatherings. And the last line of this verse would be, "May our knowledge turn into light. May our knowledge turn into light." So, with this thought, may the presence of Saraswati, the knowledge of Saraswati, put us in touch with our own intrinsic creativity. I've been very delighted to see some of the contributions that are coming in on the listserv as people share paintings and poems, really allowing your personal creativity to flow out in service of this wisdom that we're all sharing. So the creative power of Shakti, the creative power of Saraswati, actually expresses itself through each of us uniquely. And part of the contemplation that we're going to practice with this week is really to continue a process that we started last week as we looked into the goddess Bhuvaneshwari, that is to look at what goddess wants to express through you. So the secret of partnering with goddess, especially with the goddess Saraswati, is not so much to try to get her to support you in what you do. It's actually to learn how to get quiet enough to discover how she expresses herself as you, as the unique creativity through your body and mind, as the unique expression of divinity that is your human self. In many of the Western traditions, particularly in the Sufi tradition, there's a teaching that every human being is an expression of a particular name of God, so of a particular divine quality. So these qualities are, you know, qualities like love, freedom, omniscience, truth, perfection, wisdom. And for many of us, as we study the goddesses in this class, we begin to recognize how our own expression is connected with one or another of the goddesses. I know that Saraswati is, I like to think of her as the muse goddess. You know, in the West, there's a tradition of the nine muses who govern the arts and expression. We have Saraswati who governs all of it. So when we look at the great artistic expressions, for example, Mozart's music or Maria Callas's voice, we start to recognize that there are particular forms of creative expression, of artistic expression, that actually put us in touch with the divine in a very immediate way. And a great being once said that artists can be closer to God than religious people, even though artists can be eccentric, unconventional, not particularly virtuous in the, you know, in the way that we normally think of virtue. But in order to create, artists have to tune into the real heart of the source. And very often when they tune into it, the expression that they come out with is quite revolutionary, sometimes almost violent and intense. But almost everybody who creates at this level, especially true of musicians, but really of every artist, actually requires that you tune in to her. So even though religion can circle around the experience of the divine, and religions tend to invent or to require rules and channels that they claim divine power has to flow through. But I think we all know that when you actually have a real world problem, something that you have to solve in the world, and for me it's usually been creative problems, just because that's what I do, then the creative problem itself becomes a kind of a koan, and your need for inspiration, your need for the problem to be solved, actually becomes the vehicle through which you open to and receive the creative power of the goddess. So some of us find our way to the divine through compassion, through caring, others through personal love, some through self-inquiry or meditation or service, you know, actually lending our hands and our bodies to action. But, you know, if you're someone who loves that moment when you reach into the dark places of your blank mind and touch the one whose gifts pour out as words or notes that seem to have born anew in that moment, then you're a child of Saraswati. And this is kind of my experience, my first experience of actual ecstatic flow states happened when I started writing stories. I was 11, and they were not good stories by any means. In fact, the reaction of other people to my stories was so unwelcoming that I stopped doing it for a long time. But when I actually sat and wrote, this enormous bliss would well up and pour through me. I had no way of recognizing what it was. But years later, I attended a workshop on the goddess Saraswati, and in the workshop, the people who organized the workshop had put up a gigantic statue, a life-sized carved statue of Saraswati made out of sandalwood. And as I looked at her, this feeling came through me that I recognized from those moments. And I realized that it had also been that energy that I experienced, you know, things I like to do, creative things I like to do when I dance or when I would sing Broadway show tunes into the darkness at night when I was a teenager. That, you know, so, and if you think back on your own experience with creative expression, especially when it's natural creative expression where you don't feel, you know, kind of bound by the rules or by what your teachers in art school told you, you can probably start to find that energy, that quality of flow and joy that moves through language, through movement, through sound, or through painting or weaving. And this is certainly what happened to me, your fear or your desire to do things right or other people's opinions or just, you know, getting distracted created blocks to that flow. Or maybe the ego took over when you did something good and claimed it. For most of us in creative work, it takes a lot of practice before we can manifest something that other people find interesting. But the other thing that we discover when we begin to become real Shaktas is that we can court the presence of the goddess. We can really ask for her blessing. Even more than that, we can ask for her to create through us and to learn the pathways, which might be mantra, which might be meditation, which might be just asking, and eventually learning how to find that sweet spot. And it is actually a sweet spot where you feel that you connect to the force of inspiration. And also, and I want to stress this very deeply, and also you realize that you cannot do it with your ego. You really, truly need her. And really the secret is to recognize who it is that creates, which any prolific artist knows. I recently heard an interview with Bob Dylan, who was talking about his early songs, which, you know, I think certainly people my age recognize as having been radical, you know, so important, so powerful. And he, in his early years, he just wrote a string of these songs that seemed to flow from him as almost without effort. And he, commenting on this later, he said, there was a period in my life, I'm paraphrasing, and this is not an exact quote, but there was a period in my life when this music just flowed, and it, you know, it would take 5 minutes to write a song. And then after a while, it wasn't like that anymore. Of course, he's written dozens and dozens of songs since then. But as he correctly saw, that extremely inspired flow that was, you know, transformational for the whole pop world, pop music world, was, you know, it happened over a period of a few years. And, you know, real creativity is a gift. Elizabeth Gilbert once gave a great TED Talk, which maybe some of you have seen, and if not, I recommend it, about the experience of being inspired by the muses. She calls them the muses. And she began by talking about the suffering that artists and would-be artists experience if they're trying to create, and this goes for everything, whether it's, you know, a report or a school paper or pretty much anything that we do. If we're trying to do it with the ego's goals in mind, trying to satisfy a professional ambition or be praised, or in her case, as she shared, write a book that would be as popular as Eat, Pray, Love. She said that in the ancient world, artists really did not believe that they were the ones doing their own work. They understood that it was the muses, we would say the goddess, who created their art. So you court the muse, and you hopefully learn how to get out of the way and let her do the work to bypass the ego. So the question always is, how do we balance our courtship of the goddess with our own skills and with the demands of techniques? So one of the ways that we court Saraswati is actually by getting our ass on the chair, as it were, picking up the instrument, sitting down at the piano, making the decision to do what we have to do. It's Elizabeth Gilbert calls it aspiration, meaning sit on your butt until you loosen the wellsprings. But at the same time, and this is the thing, it's the effort, the tapas that you do in order to be ready to receive the creative inspiration is not enough if you do it with the sense that you're the doer, that you're the maker. And it's extremely frustrating, sometimes boring and quite discouraging. So I've found that you just have to start and end with asking the help of the goddess. So I've noticed a couple of signs that show me that she's present. First, that when Saraswati is really active, there's a sense of flow. Words come out. The voice flows without blocks. You know, if you're drawing or painting, the form tends to take shape. Now, secondly, the flow can go two ways. It can be pure gold, filled with truth and power, but it can also be, and I'm talking here about words because that's what I do, but I think we can all apply it to our own practice. It can also be pure glibness, pure cliche, the easy answers, or it can just be bullshit, as if we're sourcing not the depths of the goddess, but her frothy, foaming surface, you know, the all the ways in which words or sounds have been, you know, have become, let's say, stale. You know, they've been recycled so many times that they don't have any juice in them anymore. And so in the great game of courting the goddess, it's always important to move past her surface into her depths. And, of course, that's the effort. It's like in Dancing with Saraswati, we actually learn how to discriminate between the bad ideas and the wrong notes by exercising careful attention to the craft. But before we can do that, we often need to unblock the flow. And as a writer, I learned to do this by sitting and letting myself write without editing, just sort of similar to the way singers warm up the voice by doing vocal exercises, or the advice Julia Cameron gives in The Artist's Way, where you just write whatever comes up, sort of letting all your cliched thoughts flow out on the page before you start editing them. And at a certain point, the surface opens and you shift into depth. So let's take a moment of silence and breath. Allowing the breath to flow in as though it's flowing in from the universe, flowing in horizontally from in front, behind, from all sides, flowing from above and from below, drawing your attention into the inner body, and allow the thought, Om Ayin Saraswati Tyai Namaha, Om Ayin Saraswati Namaha, Om Ayin Saraswati Namaha, offering the sounds as though into the altar of your heart, as though the mantras are being poured into the heart, Om Ayin Saraswati Namaha, Om Ayin Saraswati Namaha. So here's the story of Saraswati's birth in the world. The version of the story that I'm going to tell you, which is also in the book Awakening Shakti, comes from the Puranas, which are the mythological books of India. And the story, the version I'm going to tell you is what I guess we could call the patriarchal version. And in the patriarchal version of most of the goddess stories, she's a consort, described as the power of the masculine deity. But since in the ultimate sense the divine is equally god and goddess, and again, we want to remember that at this level of reality, gender is not even in the picture. But the meeting of God and Goddess is the meeting of awareness, that transcendent awareness that stands apart from the world, and the force of love, creative urgency, knowledge, and power that expresses itself as the world. So in this story, the grandfather god, Brahma, his name is often translated as the immensity or the vastness, which I think is a nice way of describing the masculine creator god. He's been assigned the task, or he's agreed to do the task of creating a universe. And like artists everywhere, he can't figure out how to do it. Faced with the vastest blank page, the biggest empty canvas that has ever existed, he is completely lost and stymied and frustrated. He meditates, he doodles, he sings mantras, he prays, and finally, he prostrates himself before the great goddess, before the goddess Bhuvaneshwari. In the story that we told last week, this all happens at that moment. It happens after the gods have a glimpse of Bhuvaneshwari's world. So Brahma, who has gotten the information that there's some necessity for becoming present to the divine feminine, actually asks the goddess for help, asks her for grace. We can say he asks Bhuvaneshwari for grace. And as he is praying, there literally flows from his tongue, she manifests through Brahma's tongue as he chants the mantras, a beautiful goddess, pure luminous brightness, color of moonlight, exquisitely beautiful, brimming with power. And she rides a swan, which, as we know, represents the power of discriminating wisdom. And she flows out of Brahma's mouth with a stream of exquisite music, emanating like a cloud around her. So her robe is made of frozen light. Her robe itself quivers with melody, with mantras, and he hears the sounds that she's making. Seed mantras like Om, Aim, Hrim, Shrim, Om, Shrim, Hrim, Shrim. Mantras that contain the vibratory resonance that will become the elements of nature, that will become space, that will become stars and planets, all the different life forms. So she's manifesting as the mantras, as the vibratory resonances at the heart of reality, and as the harmonies, the vibrations, the frozen music that's going to set in motion the process of manifesting multiple universes and even universes in which there are no forms, creating the great interweaving of space, time, and matter, exploding as quarks and atoms and all the energies within them. And she's doing it through her song. She's doing it through this music, this resonance that is her, it's inseparable from her light form. So Saraswati is creative sound. She is mantra. And when she sings the universes into existence, she sows the seeds of the sounds that will naturally evolve into different forms. In tantric tradition, it's said that there are two simultaneous pathways that occur as the infinitely subtle manifests as the physical, the path of name, which is the mantras, and the path of form, which is the physical effects of the mantras. So her body flows into infinite colors and shapes like an ecstatic kaleidoscope of light. And I just want to give you a moment to imagine the goddess Saraswati as a spiraling multicolored vortex of ecstatic creativity, because that is who she is. The the full glory of the goddess is literally mind-blowing. It's completely mind-blowing. And if you've ever had such a vision like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, it's kind of overwhelming. So, in fact, it's some of the legends of the goddess. It's said that even Shiva, her divine husband, is overwhelmed at the flow of the goddess's ecstatic creativity. And this is what happens to Brahma. He's amazed and terrified, and he becomes the witness of Saraswati's dance. And as he watches her, the flow of mantras, that is the emanation of her body, flows into his body. And he's able, by reciting the mantras that he has, I won't even say learned from her, because she's his own speech, as she is ours. And through that recognition, he's able to create the universes that we know. So, Om Aim Saraswatiya Namaha. Just let the mantras flow with the breath into the heart. I find this story really interesting, partly because it actually describes the process that we all go through in our creative attempts, and you know, which really means in creating anything. Doesn't have to be a work of art. First of all, Brahma has to go through a lot of effort, a lot of personal suffering, and ultimately a decision to persevere, to stay with it. So he commits himself completely and passionately to the job. You know, he sticks to the task even when he wants to quit, even when he thinks it's impossible, because he knows that if he doesn't do it, nobody else will do it. Necessity is not only the mother of invention, it's really perhaps the condition which allows you to do something really big. So in the sages have a word for this, which we actually came up last week. The word is tapas, T-A-P-A-S, not the wonderful form of Spanish small plates, but tapas means burning. It literally means heating. Raimundo Panikkar, who was a wonderful Vedic scholar, translated tapas as ardor, you know, the burning ardor, A-R-D-O-R, that gives us so much enthusiasm for the project that it carries us. So the heating of tapas is the burning that comes from passion, from commitment, from the necessity of making something beautiful, of creating a new world, of changing things, you know, of making the world better, something that a lot of us are experiencing now, as we look at what's going on in the external world. We feel this ardor to change. So Brahma did everything he could, and then he came to an impasse. And it was when he had run out of options that he turned inside and prayed and actually let go. He confessed his inability to do the task. And that was when Saraswati arose from within him as the natural flow of inspiration, as the natural flow of his own inner goddess, his own creative birthright. And, you know, of course, when the goddess Saraswati manifests for us, she comes through as our own innate talents and skills for the job at hand. And, of course, she comes to those who've done the work, as we said already. Mozart, I have always felt, was a supreme example of the Saraswati-inspired, the goddess-inspired composer, and yet he worked really, really hard. There's a, you know, a legend about Mozart that all he had to do was kind of sit down and take dictation from the higher realms, but in fact he spent most of his time writing music. So it was his years of study and practice that let it come into form. And for many of us, the moment of impasse is the fertile moment. It's the moment when she hovers very close to us. In the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, there's a verse which we work with a lot in these classes. It's verse 22 of the Vijnana Bhairava. Verse 71. There's a similar verse in the Spandakarikas, and it says that Shakti in her full creative form is fully established in certain moments. For example, in intense anger, in joy, in terror, and in the moment of impasse, in the moment when you don't know what to do. And for me, this is one of the most important teachings of the Tantra, that when you really don't know what to do, when you're totally stuck, and instead of, you know, running around like a headless chicken, you actually turn inside, face into the impasse, and look for the Shakti in it, that, you know, in that desperate feeling, that need for grace lets her pour her inspiration through us. And I do believe that, you know, when we talk about the state of the world now, part of what we're being asked to do is become really aware of our own desperate need for change so that solutions can start to arise from a different state of consciousness than the what created the problem. So your awareness is with the breath and the heart and the mantras. Om Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. See if you can feel the resonance, the vibration of these sounds as they're breathed into the heart space. Perhaps it feels most comfortable to inhale the mantras through the third eye, through the Ajna Chakra. Perhaps it feels as though they are being sung to you from somewhere in space. Just let yourself fully become present to Om Aim Saraswatyaya Namaha. So here's the sequel. The first piece of it is that Brahma naturally takes the credit for the breakthrough. And this is what often happens. You know, we do our work, we receive inspiration, and it works, it's successful. And, you know, then we put our name on the title page, or we put our name on the audio file, we put our initials on the painting, even though it's Goddess, it's Saraswati, who is the hidden force behind our words and actions, who's made it all happen through us, even behind our mental processes, we forget her part in it. And there's a huge paradox here, which I think we all have to come to terms with as we work with our human embodiments of the divine. In other words, Goddess is us. Saraswati is you. The words that you speak, the thoughts that come through you, the inspirations that come through you, it's all you. It's not that there's some separate force that's making this happen. And yet, for most of us, most of the time, there's the higher level of connectedness to Goddess often is experienced only when we're willing to call her, rise to her, seek her with real intention. And, you know, this is, I would say this is Goddess not as, not as the, let's call it, not in her mundane form as our body-mind, but Goddess as awake, alive, palpable, divine presence. And I've found that to experience that deep, direct connection with the Goddess, it's often necessary to turn to her consciously. Not always, but in general, it's a really good idea to ask, to say, Saraswati, please help me. But what happens often is that we turn to her when we're needy and we forget about her when we're not, or we relegate our moments of connection with Goddess to peak experiences and just fail to see the miracle of her presence the rest of the time. It's sort of like that Nasruddin story, which some of you may have heard. It's about how Nasruddin had a gold coin that it was very valuable and he was very attached to, and he lost it. And he began to pray, and as many of us do when we pray, he made a deal with God. He said, God, if you'll bring me my coin back, I promise I will sell it and give half the proceeds to the poor. So as he finished his prayer, he opened his eyes, and there was the gold coin sitting on the floor in front of him. And he folded his hands and he said, okay, God, never mind, I found it myself. So this is what we sometimes do. You know, we take credit for a job well done. And Brahma not only took credit, he decided that he would possess the Goddess. He'd fallen in love with her, of course. And he wanted her for himself. He wanted her for his wife. So Brahma marries Saraswati. And assuming that they'll settle down and live a normal life in the new world. But Saraswati is not a domestic goddess. And this is one of the interesting qualities about her. She's an artist. She's a musician. She's a scientific innovator. She's a writer. And she's not faithful. She flows where she's called. But she also chooses her special favorites, the poets and the musicians and the teachers that she chooses, you know, that she, for her own reasons, falls in love with. So she was always disappearing from Brahma's house to answer the call of the singers and the musicians and the philosophers. So, and when she was home, she liked to spend her time making up mantras and writing philosophy, and then she would find a philosopher to channel her wisdom through. Even in her dreams, Saraswati travels across the world to give her grace to those beings who become known as inspired artists and musicians, the great singers and poets of the world. And I have to tell you one anecdote, which comes from Elizabeth Gilbert, actually. She tells the story of the musician and lyricist Randy Newman, who is apparently a special favorite of the goddess of inspiration, whom he calls his muse, who apparently will, when he can't get an idea, when he can't find the tune, or when the words of a lyric don't come to him, he'll charge around the studio screaming at the top of his voice, where are you? Where are you? Muse, where are you? So she has a lot of lovers, Saraswati. And eventually, there was a crisis. So in Indian ritual, there are certain ceremonies which cannot be performed except by a couple. And Brahma and Saraswati were supposed to perform one of these ceremonies. Could not be done unless Saraswati was present. She'd promised to come, but the night of the sacrifice, it was a fire sacrifice, she felt the call to bring eloquence to a philosopher in Greece and a musician in northern India and a Persian poet, and she was sitting in meditation with her consciousness spread all over the planet, channeling wisdom, music, and language, when Brahma's messenger burst into the room to tell her to get going. And Saraswati startled out of her divine trance, and she does what many of us will do when we're interrupted in a moment like that. She says, she doesn't use the language that you or I might have used. She simply says, "Tell Brahma I divorce him," and then went back to her meditation. So Brahma was, of course, infuriated. Saraswati then invited a minor goddess to be the wife of Brahma. His new wife, who later became not so minor, was Gayatri, the Shakti, whose form is the famous mantra Om Bhurbhuva Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam. You may know this mantra. It's very popular in the yoga world in versions by Deva Premal and by Wa. And the Gayatri became the official mantra of priests and upper-class students of the Vedas. And Gayatri became the goddess of Orthodox Brahmanism for many years, the priestly religion of the Vedas. And until the internet took it all over the world, now everybody does it. Om Bhurbhuva Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Devod. Oops, I'm forgetting it. Okay, I'm just forgetting it. I'm sorry. It was only allowed to be chanted. I guess I'm not supposed to say it over the airways. It was only given to Brahmin boys who were studying Vedic ritual and to members of the highest caste. And by the way, Brahma, for various reasons, I like to think because of his treatment of Saraswati, was never worshipped again. There are no temples to Brahma in India, though his image appears in other temples. Saraswati, meantime, was free to move to the forms in the form of inspiration to every place and time. Om Bhurbhuva Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Devo Mutasya Vittimahi Tano Udra Prachodayat. We're going to do a practice now, and then we're going to do Q&A. While I try to remember the words of the Gayatri Mantra, which is now driving me crazy. So close your eyes. Find your posture. Tune into the heart. Feel yourself breathing in the words of the mantra, Om Aim Saraswatyai Namaha. Is there a question that you would like to ask her? Just notice the first question that pops up in your mind. And allowing the mantra to flow with the breath, mingle the question with the mantra as well. So if you're thinking Om, Aim Saraswatiay Namaha, ask yourself, should I change my job? Is it a good idea to talk to so-and-so about this issue that I've noticed? Whatever the question is, can be a big one or a small one, just allow yourself to breathe the question in, implanting it in the heart. And I'm going to ask you to do something that we wouldn't do if we were sitting in a big group. I'm going to ask you to speak the answer. Just whatever comes up, don't censor yourself. Don't worry if the words make any sense. Maybe you'll find yourself speaking in tongues. But as you ask this question, just open your mouth and let words come out with the understanding that these words are being spoken by the goddess Saraswati. Speaking into the room where you're sitting. I'm assuming that most of you are by yourself or in the car. It's also acceptable to write the words. Let the question be answered as though the goddess Saraswati is speaking these words through your voice. We said earlier that Saraswati has a hidden quality. So when she takes form as intuition, as in this way, her energy is a very small voice, sometimes hard to hear behind the chatter of the mind. So very often we have to prime it, and one of the ways we do this is by asking ourselves a question and then holding still until the answer comes. We've done it in a very short form this evening. And I want to encourage you to do this practice during the week. It's going to be one of your homework assignments. The secret here is to actually see if we can resist the impulse to try to figure it out. And that's an interesting process because, of course, when you ask a question, your mind starts coming up with answers. But one of the reasons why it's helpful to cultivate this practice is that you can teach yourself to get quiet enough or focused enough or patient enough to discern the voice of the inspiration or the intuition, to move past the inner critic, actually, and allow something deeper to come through. One of the really powerful ways to court inspiration is actually to ask yourself a question that really matters to you, you know, which might be something like, why do we meditate? Or what does it really mean to surrender? Or what is the truth about this situation? To ask yourself that question, ask the goddess to give you an answer, and then go into your day and make space for the answer to surface. It's actually a process by which you discover how much wisdom is actually available to you, how much wisdom there really is to that you can not only show you what's true, but can also show you what to do in times when you actually need to find inspiration inside. I had an experience a number of years ago that I've sometimes shared, which was a little bit of my trial by fire in courting inspiration. I was traveling at the time with one of my teachers, Guru Mai, and we were giving a big weekend program. I was supposed to give a talk on Kundalini in the afternoon after lunch. She was giving a talk in the morning. And everything had been sort of worked out in advance. She knew what we were talking about. We knew what she was talking about. But when she started her talk, it immediately became apparent that she had decided, probably on the spur of the moment, to speak about Kundalini, to speak about the topic that I was supposed to speak about in the afternoon. And I was sitting there going, oh my God. And every now and then she would sort of give me this mischievous look and continue her talk. So when the presentation was over, I think I had about an hour to figure it out. I found a corner and I began to ask for inspiration. I just began to ask, what shall I talk about? Because it was clear that I could not talk about the subject that I had prepared to talk on. And little by little, three or four words at a time, ideas began to come into my mind. And it really felt like squeezing cheese through cheesecloth. It was incredibly slow, painstaking, and kind of excruciating. And after about 45 minutes, I had something I could give as a talk. And somehow I did it. And afterwards, Gurmai called me and she said, "So, what did you do? How did you do it?" I explained the process to her. She started to laugh. She said, "This was the only way that I could ever have gotten you to trust your own inspiration rather than trying to prepare something." So I have to say, she was right. Sometimes, you know, you need to be pushed to come up with something like that. But it showed me then and really forever after, as I hope you also know or will soon know, that whatever we need to know is there, and that through the grace of the goddess, it will be revealed if we care enough, if we ask. So, speaking of questions, we're going to take a few moments and answer some questions. So, in our tradition, Deb, can you explain how we're going to take the questions?
Yeah, you can push star 2, and that hand raises your hand for me to be able to see and unmute you. Or you can post a question via the web Q&A, and I will speak that one when they come through. So if you have a question, hit star 2, and I will unmute you for to speak with Sally. And we have one from New York.
Hi, this is Ritu. Hi, Sally. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Ritu. Nice to hear your voice.
Yours, too. It's been lovely. I wanted to, if it's okay with you, Sally, I thought I would share with the Gayatri Mantra.
Oh, fantastic.
So, excuse my
singing. Are you
going to sing
it?
But yes. Yeah, that's the only way I can.
I know,
like the Hail Mary.
Right, I know.
Om Purva Vaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Deva Yadimahi Diyo Yora Rajonarayat.
Yes, thank you, me too. And as you started to sing, it came back to me just. That's fantastic. And thank you. Thank you so much. Your voice carries the heart of it. It was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm seeing another hand.
Yep, and I just unmuted them.
Okay. You're appearing as anonymous.
If you just go ahead and speak if you raised your hand.
Hello? Do you hear me?
Hello. Yes.
Oh, goody. This is Joyce. I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Hi, Joyce.
My question is this. The relationship of the experience of the Blue Pearl and Saraswati. I was in Bali. I spent 10 years going back and forth working with one teacher. And I was way up in the northern part of the island at a temple, not one that you would know, anybody would know as a tourist. And she was trance dancing around me as we had done, and then whacked me and then asked me what I saw. And eventually what happened was I lost the ability both to see or to move. I could talk. And all I could experience in myself was a blue pearl. And I didn't know about the blue pearl at that time. But the second thing I saw was a goddess emerging from the water. And I didn't know who she was. And as you spoke of Saraswati, I went, could it have been her? And I've been to Gyanyar in Bali, which has a statue of Saraswati, all in white, that's like three stories high, that I have pictures of. So my question is, what might be, are you familiar with, or probably are, you're so wise, my dear, the relationship of the blue pearl and Saraswati?
Well, first of all, let me say something about what the blue pearl is, because it's not something that everybody knows about. The blue pearl is the name that one of my teachers actually gave to a light that appears in meditation, not to everybody, but it's not totally unusual. The light is a kind of a sky blue. It's very small. It's about the size of a sesame seed. And it's been spoken about by esoteric teachers in several traditions. And some people say that when Jesus talked about the pearl beyond price, that was what he was talking about. What my guru called the blue pearl, what he said about the blue pearl was it is the form of the divine, taking the form of a light within us. And one of the qualities of this vision is that when you see it, it's very often accompanied by a feeling of, I would call it, extreme specialness. Not always, but sometimes you really sense that it's something quite extraordinary. And sometimes it just flashes for a second, often not in meditation, and it disappears. So the blue pearl, or that light, is associated with the divine, not necessarily in a particular form, but if you have a connection with a deity form, very often that light, that blue point, that blue pearl will reveal the form of the divine that you have been connected to. So, for instance, in my guru's case, he had at one point a vision in which this light kind of opened up and expanded, and he saw the image of Shiva, who was his Ishtadevata, appearing inside the light. So it sounds to me as though you were having a vision of God in the form of goddess, and it very well could have been Saraswati. I don't know of any particular text which connects the two, though what I would say is that Saraswati is often associated with the Ajna Chakra, with the center in the middle of the head, and the blue pearl is also associated with that chakra. So very often when it emerges, or when we see it in a vision, we see it in the third eye, or we see it in front of us as if it were emerging from the third eye. So I would say it's a good thought. But I would say more than that, more than anything, it indicates that you have a deep natural connection to the divine feminine, to deity in that form.
Oh, thank you. And I also, when I was there, found a beautiful carving of Saraswati from sandalwood, which is here with me now. And,
oh, beautiful, beautiful.
I, as we started these classes, did a special offering of flowers to her, and so it's just like this kind of vibrating energy. And I love the class about Durga and the second class, and have just been doing the work and reading your book every night along with it.
Oh, beautiful.
But
beautiful.
Now Saraswati is just so strong, and I've written two books. I'm a scientist background, doctorate in biophysics, had a near-death experience, changed careers, done healing work now for 34 years. And there's another book stirring that somebody that I really trust criticized, and it needs a new direction. And I was just stuck with it. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, the words came out. So thank you.
Wow. Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah. I have a Balinese Saraswati sitting on my desk right now. She's very beautiful, elongated form, standing on a swan. So thank you for bringing Bali into the conversation.
Shelley, we have a question from the webcast. Heather asked, does Bhuvaneshwari, have a birth story?
Does she have? No. And one reason that she doesn't, I believe, is that she's the goddess who's never born. She's that which is all that is. So we could say that her birth story is the self-recognition that arises in the transcendent at the moment when the impulse to manifest a world comes forth. Saraswati is, though she's a goddess who is honored as, the full divine, absolute face of the goddess by many people. In the mythological traditions, she's often considered to be a goddess who's sort of one step below the great goddess. So in other words, she's one of the daughter goddesses, if we can say that Bhuvaneshwari is the mother. Saraswati and Lakshmi are her daughters. So yes, Saraswati is birthless and deathless and ever-existent. Thank you for that question.
It was actually they were asking about
About Bhuvaneshwari, yes.
Yeah.
And I just said, just actually answered the question.
Oh,
I said Bhuvaneshwari she doesn't have a birth story because she's never born.
All right. And then Karen asks, is the blue pearl different from the blue light that often comes in her meditation? It is a deep blue and surrounded by a yellowish gold-green ring.
That's another form of that light. That dark blue light with the yellow ring, again, I see it sometimes in the Ajna Chakra. I actually consider it an inner vision of the Ajna Chakra. And it is definitely connected to the blue pearl, but I would just tell you that these questions, is this somewhat larger blue spot that I sometimes see the same as the tiny blue dot that they call the blue pearl? And the answer is yes and no. It's a different form of this same principle, which is the light of the world, the light of the divine inside the human body. The blue pearl, or the blue bindu, as it's sometimes, the nila bindu, as it's sometimes called. Bindu means dot or point. It's a point. In other words, it's a very specific sesame seed-sized point, which sometimes shows up as black, sometimes shows up as white, but it's distinguished by its size, by its intense luminosity, and by the fact that it tends to dart in and out. Whereas, at least in my experience of that dark blue circle, that light often stays longer. It's not quite as evanescent. So hopefully that answers your question. Now we're in the realm of esoteric visual experiences.
All right, we have somebody, it looks like, maybe from North Carolina.
Okay. Hello.
Hi, this is Gail.
Hi, Gail.
I have a question about Bhuvaneshwari and Shakti, because their description almost seems like the same thing. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about how things, I guess you could say, descend, like from Shiva to Shakti, and then how does it go between the goddesses the gods, and then beings of, you know, ascended masters, gurus, how does it kind of come down? And I know we talked a little bit about this in our last class, but I didn't quite get it. So so Shiva,
well,
so Shakti,
it doesn't,
and Bhuvaneshwari,
it's not, okay, so first of all, it's getting it is not quite a matter of getting the list right. So,
okay.
In other words, but I will give you, I'll give you a map, which I want to say very strongly, a map is a map. It's not the territory. So, first of all, Shiva Shakti are not different. You know, in the ultimate sense of the word, awareness love or awareness power or consciousness bliss, that they're different names for them, Satchit Ananda, Chit Ananda, are they're words which describe the innate quality of the absolute reality, which is both still and creatively empowered. And the stillness, I know you know this, but the stillness is what we call the Shiva aspect. The power and blissfulness and creativity is what we call the Shakti aspect. So Shiva and Shakti are the two sides of the ultimate reality. Now, the goddess Shakti, which literally means power, it's an abstract word, in fact. So, but when Shakti takes form, and she has, as we've said earlier, many, many forms, she's given a couple of names. Bhuvaneshwari is one of them that represent. Mahadevi is another. And at that level of consciousness, the names Bhuvaneshwari, Mahadevi, Kali, Durga, all of these are names that are given to the ultimate reality in the form of goddess. And so if you want to talk about God as goddess, you know, in the Indian tradition, you might give the name Shiva to God, or you might give the name Vishnu to God, or you might give the name Bhagwan to, you know, there are various names which are, we could call them the sectarian names for the absolute, or Brahman. If you're expressing your experience or your conviction that the ultimate reality has the nature of the feminine, you would call her Bhuvaneshwari or Mahadevi, which means great goddess, or Durga, or Kali. Kali is actually one of the deepest and most popular forms in which the great goddess is worshipped. So, as the energy, as Shakti, so to speak, descends into more denser manifestation, still at a very high level, she descends to a plane that's sometimes called Ishwara Tattva, which is the plane of personal divinities. And that's where she takes on names like Saraswati or Lakshmi or Krishna. In other words, the individual deity forms of the what I call the big deities, the forms of the divine, which have lights, they have mantras, they often have particular forms that we can see, that we can visualize. And then at a certain point, Maya, the quality of differentiation, comes in. And it's at that once below Maya, there are worlds of that we call the God worlds, in which deities like Indra, the elemental deities, etc., they all reside in the plane just below Maya. So there's a differentiation made between deities who are actually the forms of the Absolute and deities who are very high, elevated forms, but not quite at that level. And the Ascended Masters occupy realms that sort of segue between the realms below Maya and the realms just above Maya. So in the cosmology of, in the Indian cosmologies, there are a number of realms of worlds, subtle realms, which are associated with different kinds of creatures. And the different texts, the different mythological texts, describe them differently. Different traditions describe them differently. But in almost all of the traditions, there are realms that are considered to be the realms of particular deities. For instance, there's a realm called Goloka where devotees of Krishna hang out when they've ascended to higher states of consciousness. There's a realm called Brahmaloka, which is one of the places where ascended masters spend time. Apparently, the different traditions have their own planes or realms, and they generally correspond to each other. In other words, the angelic realms, for example, that are spoken of in Western traditions correspond to the realms of ascended masters in some of the Eastern traditions. But the maps of these realms are different. So I don't feel qualified to say absolutely it's like this or it's like that, but to simply recognize that there are a number of very subtle realms where beings who give blessings reside. Sometimes they're called angels, sometimes they're called ascended masters, sometimes they're called mantras in Kashmir Shaivism. These realms, one of these realms is called the realm of the Mantreshwaras, who are beings who are the embodied forms of mantras, similar to ascended masters or angels. So I hope that helps, Gail. Oh, you're so welcome.
It does. I guess.
I'm not there. You know, there's.
I wanted to understand it better.
It's not a cookbook. It's not a cookbook.
Yeah. I was feeling into like bhakti devotion, when I was feeling into it, it felt like I was looking up at something, you know, like looking up at the divine, and then I've had an experience of feeling like, if I feel like I invite the goddess to come into me, and the feeling of being the goddess is different. You know, it's just different from the bhakti love of looking up to something. And so I was playing with that too, and just, I guess, feeling
well,
the difference
so,
in that.
So yes, and that, you know, you're absolutely right. There's a very distinct experience of looking up to a felt sense of the divine, and finding that felt sense of the divine inside. These are different, you know, in Sanskrit, the name for the difference in experience is bhava. So we have a particular bhava, which means a spiritual attitude, when we are feeling devotion for something outside ourselves, which is kind of the normal way that we relate to deities, and a very different bhava, a more non-dual bhava, when we recognize the divine as being everywhere, and an interior bhava when we recognize the divine as ourselves. All of these are true, at, you know, depending on your level of consciousness and on your experience at the moment. They are very they're very distinct experiences, and some traditions will say one is better than the other. My own feeling is that they're all flavors of an extremely exalted movement through the different ways that we can relate to the infinitely subtle grace-bestowing powers that we all have access to. So yeah, looking up feels different than looking in. And that's part of the joy of individuation and, you know, the infinite variety of spiritual experience. So I think it's great that you have both of these experiences, and there are many, many other layers and flavors of connection to the divine that can occur. It's literally endless. One of the texts of the tradition says, endless are the names, endless are the forms, endless are the experiences of the infinite, because it's infinite.
That makes so much sense. And how Baba, in his book, Play of Consciousness, talks about visiting so many different worlds and having so many different experiences and flavors and everything. So,
Yeah.
Thank you. That softened it for me.
It does. And I think we always have to be very careful, because the human mind tends to be very linear. So we tend to sort things in terms of, okay, is this the right way to see it? Is this higher than that? Is this the ultimate, or is this something less than that? If you soften your understanding around how experience reveals itself, it allows your experience to surprise you, you know, to show you what it has to show you, and it allows you to really be open to all the different layers and levels of connection that you're going to experience throughout your practice. So, my dear ones, we are at the end of our time. I thank you for your questions. I thank you so much, Ritu, for singing the Gayatri for us. Om Bhur Bhuvah Swaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Diyo Yonah Prachodayat. Thank you for rekindling it in my own memory. And let's just take a moment or two to tune in, to turn into the heart, to feel into the great subtlety with which Saraswati engages us through language and sound, and to meditate with the breath flowing into the heart, with Om, Aim, Saraswatyaya Namaha. Om, Aim, Saraswatyaya Namaha. Om, Aim, Saraswatyaya Namaha. Have a beautiful evening. Your homework will come tomorrow. Much love. Take care.